Session number 9005, Jeremy Black, Reel 3.
I would be concerned about the relationship between the junior officers, and not concerned. I mean, this always seemed to be one of the great strengths of the the really excellent relation that existed between the respected petty officer in chief on the one hand and the junior officer on the other. That always seemed to be one of the strengths of the relationship. That must have changed, I would have thought.
Yes, I think it has. I think the reason why it has changed is that the young officer has now machined into his years, say 18 to 24, very often a degree. So we've taken 3 years out of the time that he spent in ships to spend in a totally different way of life in a university. And his time, for instance, as a midshipman, which is a very good opportunity for people to get to know each other, has become starkly compressed. I mean, whereas I was saying I did perhaps 18 months, I had some the other day who did, I don't know, about 2 months, but more typically they'd probably do 6. And there's a lot of difference between those two, because in that 6 months he's got a lot actually to learn, a fact. And so he spends his time going around doing that, and to some extent at the expense of getting to know sailors. And the opportunities we had with boat running and that sort of thing, to be with sailors, in charge of them in little situations, that has almost totally disappeared. I did a visit just the other day in Jamaica, where we were at anchor, but it's the first one I can remember for 15 years or something. Just doesn't happen, that boat running. I quote that because it was a particular example of where a chap got away in charge of a little group. So I think that has affected it a bit. I think socially too, probably there are differences there, that the people have not got such different backgrounds as they had 20 years ago. I mean, educational backgrounds. They're very much the same people, but one chap got his A's and became a midshipman, and another chap didn't and became something else, but they might have come from the same school. And at that time, say 1950 or 30, this young chap of a more privileged background, if you like to call it that, who went to Oxford or became a midshipman or whatever, in a sense was privileged in the eyes of the law, in that an Oxford undergraduate could go and knock hell out of some bit of Oxford and get away with it, and was people would be disappointed if he didn't. And likewise, midshipmen used to come back with the Commander-in-Chief's flag or the barber's pole or do all sorts of terrible things in Gibraltar. And it was expected and seen in some quite different way to the rest of society doing a similar sort of thing. Whereas today that wouldn't be true. I mean, if a midshipman transgressed the law by borrowing the barber's pole, it'd be just the same as anybody else. He, for some reason, which I'm not quite sure about, that type of chap seemed to get away with those things then, rightly or wrongly. So there's a slight shift in the flavour.
Yes. In action stations itself, I suppose though that How did that differ from when, for example, the time you were in the that destroyer under fire?
Yeah.
From there, how did that? Were there any differences between that and the Invincible?
Difficult question. I mean, the ships were, of course, totally
so different. Yes,
that
is a great difference. But, and the kind of attack you're going to get is going to be very different, too.
Yes, I mean, here we all were in the operations room. Back in the Concorde days, we were all standing on the bridge or somewhere up on the upper deck. The scene was different. Relationships? Well, I think... Yes, I think relationships probably were different under stress, just like they are different when not under stress. I mean, I think we've got... a closer relationship up and down the scale would be my... Now, this may be anno domini, you know, it may be that I'm just seeing things differently because I stand in a different place.
The relationship between the captain of the turret and the gun's crew.
Yes, but you see, you're already pointing at an area where the changes are so stark. When I was in the Vanguard, I was the sub-lieutenant of A turret and the safety trainer, and the captain of A turret was a lieutenant commander, and we had a crew of 70. And then there was a transmitting station with the band, or whatever it was, and maybe 20 people under a gunner. And then there's the gunnery officer, who's a lieutenant commander and lives in my village. Today, in the Invincible, I had a sea dart system which would fire many times further. The mounting had two chaps, two electrical, maybe three electrical ratings, I think probably all senior rates, and they were there in their launcher position. There's no transmitting station, but the people who do the equivalent job are in the operations room, and there are three or four of those headed by either a chief petty officer or a fleet chief. And that was it. That was the tree. So it's a pretty different scene. Now that fleet chief then reported to the air warfare officer who ran the whole air battle, who was a lieutenant commander, and I sat next to him. But you can see it's a very different scene. And this fleet chief is doing the job certainly that a lieutenant would have been doing in the gun era, if not a lieutenant commander. And the whole transmitting station disappeared. So that these senior ratings, you see, are playing a role higher up the events. But so much is automated, so much comes out in the wash, really. No longer have you got people winding handles and smacking their hand down. I thought, really, it's all done by some jolly old computer somewhere. Quite different. Quite different.
But you've still got a pretty neat crew in the Invincible. They're largely protected in the flying.
1,000 men.
And the engines?
Yeah, there are quite a lot of people in the engine world. Yes, it's a good question as to what they all do. They are spread right across. For example, the Vanguard, you see, would have had dozens, hundreds of seaman ratings to man all these turrets, and whatever it was, four turrets of 70 men each, plus, and then the 525s on top of that. Now, the seamen in the Invincible...
And the signal staff, of course, too.
...were almost exclusively radar ratings. They manned the operations room. And almost nothing else. So when they were closed up, it was very difficult to find a seaman to do anything. The air engineers, of course, that's a large body of men. And the squadrons generally, I think... For example, the helicopter squadron had more officers than I had in the ship. Just one squadron. So they made up quite a lot of it.
Interesting. It's officers who fly the helicopters, and yet it's a fleet chief.
Fires the guns.
Fires the guns.
Yeah. In a helicopter's crew, there are three officers and one rating. Yeah. We've had, of course, rating air crew. In the war, there were rating air crew. The air crew are more autonomous. I was talking to somebody, Admiral Woodward about it this week. I found in the course of the fighting that my relationship with the air crew in terms of tasking them was rather tenuous. And that I would have a meeting and say, decide to strike the airfield, maybe. And my ops officer would hear that, and he would maybe tell his second ops officer to attend the briefing. And he would then give the task, and then the air crew who were going to do it would attend the briefing, and in due course of time, off they would fly. And that was the relationship, whereas when I went to bed at night, I'd write instructions for my officer of the watch, who was just one deck up, so that there was no doubt in his mind exactly what his terms of reference were. And yet I had these other people operating 150 miles away, on this very tenuous set of orders, really. And I found that it's the sort of thing that in peacetime, you see, it wouldn't really impinge upon you, because they boom off and they come back and say they sank something or other, or they bombed something, and of course they haven't anyway. So I'm assuming they return and they're still in one piece, that's more or less all right. But when it came to bombing Port Stanley Airfield, to give an example, if you bombed it going north and south, and you made a mistake, then your bombs would fall into the water or into the hillside. If you bombed it east-west, and your bomb overshot on a westerly heading, you'd put a bomb into Port Stanley town. And you can imagine the political repercussions of doing something like that. And so I became more than a little interested, and I instituted a written instruction from me to the air crew, who signed for having read the instruction, and when they came back, they debriefed onto a bit of paper saying what they had done, and that came back to me. And I find that a much...
As you would do to the officer of the watch.
As I would to the officer of the watch. And even then, I found things happened that one wasn't entirely happy about sometimes. But it just struck me, you know, it was something which was within the system of the fleet air arm, which I thought was unsatisfactory.
Were they reluctant to accept this amount of control?
Yeah, they weren't that enthusiastic, I must say. Those who'd grown up in their system, you see, I mean, it's like anybody else, they don't like change. But that's why I think it's a good thing for a non-aviator to go in command every now and again, to introduce some new thoughts.
Yes, but ultimately, you are, I mean, if in fact...
If that chap put the bomb in the wrong place, I'm in charge. You know, it's my business.
You're head for the job.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We had one or two when... I was, again, discussing one just the other day with with Sandy, where a chap who was, chap took off, or two of them, a pair from Hermes, took off to go and drop bombs on Port Stanley at the airfield at the start of their sortie, and then to take over a cap mission over the Port Stanley area, particularly to guard the Glasgow, or Coventry or somebody, who was inshore bombarding. Now, these are the, you know, this was fought with error, really, or difficulty. I was the air warfare commander. I didn't attend the briefing of those air crew, nor did I know what they were briefed to do, precisely. But when they were airborne and in an air defence role, they were my aircraft, despite the fact they came from the Hermes. I was in command. Whilst they were doing their bombing, that wasn't really an air defence matter, so they were reasonably briefed by their parent ship as to what to do. And then there was the third problem, that when they were inshore, they were actually under the control of this DLG, whoever he was. The first thing I knew was that they'd bombed a ship. It was the Narwhal, a spy ship. And, well, why had they bombed it? You know, where they got their permission from, and so on and so on. Well, I actually discovered this week that they'd got permission from the ship inshore, who in turn had got it from Sandy Woodward. But nobody had told me. You see what's happening? So, such are the real life difficulties.
What about the Admiralty ones? That didn't worry you terribly at all. I mean, the Admiralty control, the relationship between the Admiralty.
Very good. I mean, it wasn't actually my business, of course. It was the Admiral's. Mm. But the bit that, when I left home the night before I sailed, I said to my wife, one, we will fight. A lot of people thought quite differently at that time. Indeed, my ship's company didn't believe it till we sailed from Ascension as a group of people. Certainly the pressmen thought they were out for a ride around the Isle of Wight. But I told her that we would fight, and secondly, I said that we will find that we're not given adequate rein to do the job. Years ago, 10, 12 years ago, I wrote things called the Rules of Engagement, which are now used for politico-military control and have been used at Barra, Iceland, Falklands and so on. And as I say, I started with a blank sheet of paper and wrote them, the first lot. Fascinating. Rather like writing the first signal book. And we have tended to find that we have been, in our own opinion, too constrained. And it's easy to sit in Whitehall and say, don't do this and don't do that, but when you're out there, you want more freedom. And I forecast that we would have insufficient freedom to do our job. In the event, not at all. We had everything we could have wished for in plenty of time to consider it. Excellent. Very good. Very good.
Was this, you think, the consequence of better, in part, obviously it's a good deal to do with people who actually run it, but in part, was this, you think, because of better communications, more reliable communications?
No. I think it was the nerve of the people concerned. First of all, an appreciation from Whitehall, a commander-in-chief, and secondly, the willingness of the cabinet to grant us that licence. It's normally politicians who find it difficult to take the decisions, I think. No, I think it was courage in Whitehall, which was the factor. Jolly nice it was for us.
What about the, slightly changing the sort of the line, what about the Admiralty, though, in the material element, and not necessarily, not particularly with the Falklands at all, the ability of the captain of the Invincible to say, oh, there's something wrong with your, I don't know, your some part of the ship that doesn't operate properly. This is a first of class, and this should be put right in all the three ships. How well does this work, do you think?
Well, since the Falklands, for example, there's been a number of changes. We've put in the Vulcan Phalanx gun. We've got these overalls which don't burn. We've got mattresses which don't give off toxic gases. We've got various new bits of communications. We've got a new chaff dispenser. So, you know, there's been a response, undoubtedly. And likewise with the aircraft, they've got various things which were found wanting then have been corrected since. In the non-wartime setting, or non-post-war, it moves more slowly because people hold the money bags more tightly. At the end of the day, it's money. The actual corrective alterations and additions which are permitted are normally only some 7%, I think it is, of the cost of a refit. So you then have to decide what takes the priority. And if there is some very special equipment, well, then you can argue the case and get it in as a special thing. But normally, you're not allowed to fiddle about more than that sort of percentage, which is not very much. But one sees lots of criticisms of ships been written since the days. I've been in that business twice now, in the operational requirements business. You don't necessarily produce a ship the way it is because that's the way you'd like it, but because that's the best you can get for the money that the country will give you. And you forego things. And funnily enough, we were talking about it in bed this morning. My wife was on about this clothing, which wasn't very satisfactory in action. And she was being rather critical of the fact that we had action working dress made of man-made fibres, as indeed so were the press. Well, we knew perfectly well, and have done for years, that the cushions gave off, so do yours, I've no doubt, toxic fumes and all these things. I mean, they're all facts which we've known for ages. But if you, for a navy of 80,000 people, want to set up factories to make you natural fibre working dress or cushions or mattresses or what have you, it's bloody expensive. It probably costs you 10 times. And so somewhere along the line, people have made a judgment and said, well, you know, I just don't think it's worth 10 times. Or maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. But in these latest minesweepers we've got, for instance, the engines are made out of non-magnetic material. Well, they cost many, many, many times what an ordinary diesel engine costs, you see. It's a judgment that somebody takes.
What I was thinking of particularly is one of the things Mark Carr, and I think honestly, claims there that he, when he first took the ship over, said that the range at which we are going to fight will be in excess of 15,000 yards. At that range, you will get plunging shell, and our decks are not armoured.
Ah, yes. But, of course, he was talking about a battle cruiser.
Yes. This is when he first... he was saying this in 1909.
Yes.
When you took over command of the ship, and nothing, he could get nothing done about it. either no. with that class or the classes that followed. With the result, he said, we lost three battlecruisers at Jutland.
Yes.
It may be being wise after the event. I don't know.
Yes. I think what he's saying is that they couldn't afford to have battlecruisers. Because if they'd had the armour, they wouldn't have got the speed. Wasn't this really the equation?
Yes, but I think it's also the way the way the ship, though, with the actual deck armour, that it would be wiser to have taken it off the sides, where it didn't matter. Put it on the deck, where you've got the plunging shell.
Yes.
It was a protection, particularly the protection of the magazine areas.
Yes. Which, of course, proved so costly, didn't it, in that interesting turn at Jutland. Yes, well, I think there are always Mark Carrs who are always arguing this, that, or something else. I mean, as I say, that has been my business twice, the actual fashioning of the next class or classes. And it is a great debate, and nothing is straightforward. If you want A, you sacrifice B and C. You know, it's a compromise the whole way along the line. Well, presumably, he obviously failed to carry the majority with him of the naval staff, whoever they were at the time.
Yes.
And if what he says is true, well, then he was right, yeah. But he doesn't, if you like, continue the argument to say, but then if I'd only had 27 knots instead of 32, the Invincible at the Falklands would never have caught the Graaf Spee. Or, I mean, I'm being off the back of my head, but I think you've got to take the thing right along the line, because there's always you always sacrifice whatever it is you go for. You sacrifice something.
It's arguable, of course, that the battlecruiser should actually never have been made at all anyway.
I think it's entirely arguable, yes. But perhaps uniquely even, that action, I suspect, couldn't have been fought without battlecruisers, could it? So perhaps that's the defence of the battlecruiser.
Well, certainly Fisher, for all his life, in spite of Jutland, went on claiming that because of the Falklands, and rightly so, it couldn't have been, they couldn't have got out there in time otherwise.
No.
It was a very bold step to take to remove three battlecruisers from
Scarpa.
Fleet.
Yeah. Well,
and in fact, they were at that point. There were five German to four British ones at that particular point in time.
Yes.
If the Germans had come out at that stage.
Yes.
Which was a very bold thing to do, but you know, it paid off.
Yes. In connection with the two actions, I gave a dinner in Port Stanley, which replicated Sturdee's dinner in 1914. And in the course of my speech, I picked up a number of interesting parallels between the two. For example, I think I'm right in saying it took on both occasions the same number of days to get away. And the same number of days to get down there. Now, here we are. Also, on both occasions, HMS Invincible had 3 days in which to prepare itself for sailing. In a report dated 1914, there's some strangely familiar lines. Officers and men, reinforced by working parties from the nearby barracks, labored around the clock, hoisting coal, crates, and ammunition. The grime, haggard and weary, staggering men around the ship were like flies, while dockyard workmen crawled everywhere, frantically aware.